mind, you still have to give me that one file.
Sorry, ma'am.
You have to give me that one file.
Are you, I'm sorry. Yep.
Now we're going to hear. Oh my goodness. Talk to some of the times in it. That's why I figured it anyway. Should he take any one of these guns to be told anyway today? If I am, I'll cook it on my own, but that's the stuff I'm going to do. One is a couple of dubious jobs, keep us in the bay of the job. Put each one in the company for a bunch of babies. We just heard how Indra, Dave, Lord Indra, how he apologized profusely to Krishna. And he acknowledged that Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And previously, in chapter 14, Lord Brahma recognized Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Brahma's conclusion was, there's so much difference between your body and my body. The potency of your body and the potency of my body, even though you are standing there in your yellow cloth with a peacock feather on your head and a vanamala around your neck, garland of forest flowers around your neck. There's so much difference between your body and my body that others say they know something about God. But I will say nothing. So Brahma acknowledged Krishna's position, and now Indra acknowledged Krishna's position, and now it is the turn of Varuna. I believe Varuna, even though we don't think of, we don't hear much about Varuna. Does anyone know any other place where Varuna is mentioned? In that?
Sure.
Yes, yes. What was that?
I wasn't sure. When he challenged everyone in the universe, so he heard the Varuna's very powerful. When he challenged Varuna, Varuna said, no, I'm a very old man, so I'm not worthy of fighting with you. But if you meet me, if you fight with Lord Vishnu, then you'll get a worthy opponent.
Yeah.
Fighting challenge.
So he went looking for Vishnu after that.
Yeah.
And I think he indicated that he was going to get smashed.
Yes.
By Vishnu. And indeed he was correct. So now Varuna is going to have his chance to acknowledge the supremacy of the Supreme Lord. He doesn't fall into the kind of illusory behavior or anything like that that Indra fell into, or even Brahma wanting to test. Again, Brahma's conclusion was that there's so much difference in potency between your body and my body, you and me, that I cannot say I understand anything about you. So his original purpose of beginning the Brahma Mohalila was to test Krishna, to pit his potency against Krishna. He understood that Krishna was his master, but he didn't. It was hard for him to accept that this little boy, Krishna was just this beautiful little boy wandering around the cowherd fields of Vrindavan, wasn't even sitting on a throne. It was hard for him to accept that this little boy, Krishna, was his master, the unlimitedly powerful Supreme Lord. So he wanted to test Krishna, like a little boy may, he may do something to his powerful father or something. And the result of his test, his conclusion, was that you're unlimitedly powerful and my power is nothing compared to yours. I have a limited amount of power. Your power is unlimited. It is unlimited and my consciousness cannot even conceive of your power, of the scope of your power, I cannot circumscribe your potency of my consciousness. I can't conceive of it. And this is the fault of the conditioned soul, or any soul, kept with his limited consciousness, he cannot measure the supreme, the unlimited. cannot conceive of what unlimited power is. So how can we understand Krishna? We can only understand what Krishna allows us to understand. And the only way to understand and know about the personality of Godhead, that he prefers he plays the flute, for example. And he likes to herd cows, because you'll see even amongst religionists who understand God as a person, not from the Vedic side, but from the Abrahamic tradition side, as they say. Some may accept that God is a person, but as soon as you ascribe any particular characteristic, they'll say, no, how could it be? But how could it be? How could you say it can be? Because who has the power to say that God can't be like this? The unlimited can't prefer cows to pigs. Pig herdsmen, no. He likes cows. And he likes to live in the village. And he likes to play the flute, not the alto sax or any other instrument. He likes the flute. So of course we can say he has the most magnificent taste. But we can't say anything more than that. Like, why does he like this and not that? Why did he add himself in Vrindavan? Vrindavan as opposed to Bratislava or what's that place you're from again? What's the name of that little town you're from?
Melbourne.
Yeah. Oh yeah, why didn't he take his book to Melbourne or something? The town of Melbourne. He just does whatever he wants. This is what personality means. He has characteristics. So anyway, the Govardhan Puja ceremony took place on the new moon day. What is the new moon day called?
Amavasya.
It's the dark moon, where there's no moon practically in the sky. After this, the torrents of rain and hailstorms imposed by King Indra for 7 days. 9 days of the waxing moon having passed, on the 10th day, King Indra worshipped Krishna, and thus the matter was satisfactorily settled. And after this, on the 11th day of the full moon, Ekadasi, Sukla Paksha, Maharaj Nanda observed fasting for the whole day, and early in the morning of the next day, the Dwadasi, he went to take bath in the river Yamuna. Raise your hand if you've ever taken a bath in the river Yamuna. Sorry. You never bathed in the river Yamuna?
I was told it's a collision. Just put some drops on my head.
Okay. Like a bath. He went to take bath in the river Yamuna. He entered deep into the water of the river. So this pastime, it's important to see it from many points of view. So Nanda Maharaj was there early in the morning with some of his kind friends, and Krishna was not with him. So he went deep into the water of the river, but he was arrested immediately by one of the servants of Varunadev. The servant brought Nanda Maharaj before the demigod Varuna and accused him of taking a bath in the river at the wrong time. So from the point of view of the cowherd men who were with Nanda Maharaj, what did it look like? He entered the water, and then the servants of Varuna took him, even though actually they took him to Varuna Loka, through a channel that was not filled with water. And they brought him to a loka that wasn't filled with water. What did it look like?
Disappeared in the water.
Surfing accident. He drowned, it looked like. So,
is that channel that you were in, Aloka, does that go down through our ocean on this planet Earth?
Well, at least it goes from the Yamuna, and it may be very subtle. Because why would that channel just happen to be in that particular spot of the Yamuna where Nanda Maharaj was going to bathe? So maybe there's a, I don't really know, this is very fine speculating, but maybe there's a subtle connection between all water, it makes sense in Varuna Loka.
Between all water?
Well, because he's in charge of all the water, Varuna. He's the demigod in charge of water. Why? Did you want to find it in the ocean?
It intrigues me very much. I don't know why. I've got a little connection with it somehow. I don't.
Yeah? I've been called
looking for it.
Looking for it because you might get yourself into trouble.
Hellish planet, but it's just on there. Is it hellish?
Well, no, it didn't sound like it. It was wonderful.
Right.
Varuna Loka would be more heavenly than hellish.
It would be subterranean.
Subterranean is below the earth, right? I don't. I wouldn't think so because the demigods' planets are generally above the earth. But I'm in the realm beyond my capacity to. I've never heard anyone. Do you know where Varuna Loka is?
Some connection between Varuna and Yamaraj also.
Well, I don't know. Yamaraj's planet is low, below the earth. Yeah, I never heard that there was. But in any case, from the point of view of the cowherd man who was Krishna, can imagine the scene. Krishna's beloved father had entered the ocean, the river, and he had disappeared as if he had drowned. And Nanda Maharaj was so loved by all the residents of Vrindavan that even though he was the second. He wasn't the eldest of Parjanya Maharaj's eldest son, Upananda was the eldest. Still, he wasn't. Upananda acknowledged the great qualities of Nanda Maharaj and said, "You should be the king of the cowherd village." So he was beloved by everyone, and of course, Krishna was his son. So when he entered into the river and disappeared, all the cowherd men. They were full of the greatest sadness because of their love for Nanda Maharaj. Everything depends on our relationship. So you might see on television, on the news or something like that, you might see some bombing or some disaster in some part of the world, and you see the people crying, but you don't feel any emotion. One doesn't feel any emotion unless one identifies with everyone and everything in those areas. One doesn't experience any emotion because we don't have some mother or relationship. So everything depends on relationship. In spiritual life, in material life, everything depends on relationship. And the same thing with Krishna Lila. Not that one, but this one. In Krishna Lila, if one has developed his relationship with Krishna, one experiences, especially if it's in a particular rasa, one experiences all of Krishna's lila and all the emotions of it, just like one is a member of the cowherd community, if the relationship is actually developed. So as we watch some news clip of some disaster in some part of the world and you don't experience anything, it's just, you know, he changed the channel or something like that. So there's a tendency to be Krishna like that too, that, you know, it doesn't touch us in a feeling way, and this is just telling us that our relationship with Krishna is not well developed. It's like yesterday, wasn't yesterday at the feast, one body asked Maharaj about what they asked him about again. But anyway, I can't remember the exact point. But anyway, the residents of Vrindavan, because of their relationship with Nanda Maharaj, he became heartbroken, thinking that he had drowned. And when he became heartbroken, what did they do? They became filled with terror, in a sense. And they felt empty, because the beloved Nanda, the father of Krishna, the beloved Krishna, had left this world and he'd gone into the ocean. So they immediately began calling out to Krishna, because that is the one of the characteristics of the residents of Vrindavan, is that whenever there is any difficulty, they call out to Krishna. They know no other shelter except for Krishna. Their consciousness is so absorbed in Krishna, they don't know anything else but Krishna. So when Nandavas went beneath the waters, they called out loudly, Krishna, 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 come and save your father. Now, interestingly enough, Krishna wasn't present there. But also interestingly enough, there's no place that Krishna is not present. So although he didn't go to the river at that time to bathe with Nanda Maharaj, and he wasn't the most coward man, Krishna immediately heard Nanda Maharaj, the coward man calling out for him. And this is one of the benefits of having that type of relationship with Krishna, is that wherever we are, there's no place where he's not. So we can always call out to him, and he's immediately there. Nam namakari bahu vasara sakti. His name, he's there in his name, he is fully present. And this is his kindness. Tavakripa bhagavan mamapi. This is Krishna's kindness. That he's fully present in his name, making himself easily available in his name. Unfortunate as I am, I have no attraction for so many other things. But I don't have attraction for Krishna's name. I turn my back on Krishna all the time. This is the meaning of being a conditioned soul. So anyway, that's what it looked like. Now we're hearing what it was like from the point of view of Varuna more. So he went, he was accused, he was brought by one of the servants of Varuna and accused, he brought before the demigod Varuna, accused him of taking a bath in the river at the wrong time, because there are rules and regulations that govern sub asub, auspiciousness and inauspiciousness. There's a right time to do everything. One time I was speaking with Sukadev, who is in Melbourne, who was born in a Pali Brahmin family, and it was a very nice in one sense, but he was telling me how his grandfather was so strict. He was so strict he was a smarter Brahmin, so strict in following the rules and regulations. But every season there was a different direction to face when you bathed, and every complete aspect of the life was regulated by some smarter shastric injunction or another. So there's a time you eat facing this way, you eat at this time. In other words, no one had the feeling they were independent. And it's exactly the opposite of how people think and want to think nowadays. Now, every restriction is considered overbearing, practically speaking, and no one wants to tolerate any restriction. We want to be independent, and of course the irony is the more we try to be independent, the more restricted we become, the more trapped we become. By what? Our own mind. We become completely controlled by our mind. By our mind, a wild mind, out of control. So the choice is, do you want to be controlled by one's own wild mind, or which is capable of any betrayal at any moment, or do we want to be controlled by some time-honored Shastric injunction, which means by Krishna's rules and regulations. So nowadays, if you ask someone, do you want to be controlled by your wild mind, you're asking, you know, a group of thousands of people in the football stadium or the MCG or something, which would you rather be controlled by? No one will say, I want to be controlled by anything external. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And that's it. And because we are like that, because we have that fiercely independent, ferocious streak in us, meaning we have Krishna bhulesi, we don't want to be with Krishna, then we are trapped in the material world and we have to suffer the consequences of our poor choices, the poor choices that our mind forces us into. So anyway, Maharaj was good. So everything was regulated. So Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, from that mistake, he explains at the end of this pastime how Maharaj was actually correct. He knew the Shastric induction better than the servants of Varuna. He was fully religious even in that sense. And there's an injunction, something to the effect of that when there is a short titi, a short day, or the Vedic day, and you have to break the Ekadasi because there's a very short time that you can break. And sometimes when you look at the Ekadasis, we find these that there's like 20 minutes or something like that when you have to break the Ekadasi. So when there's a short titi, for breaking the Ekadasi, you can break it early. You can bathe early and things like that. So anyway, Maharaj was actually right. So he accused him of bathing at the wrong time. According to astronomical calculations, the time in which he took a bath was considered demonic. This was from the point of view of the Varuna Dutta. The fact was, Maharaj wanted to take a bath in the Yamuna early in the morning before the sunrise, but somehow or another he was a little too early, and he bathed in an inauspicious time. So, but from the other point of view, as Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur points out, there was no fault in what he did. Consequently, he was arrested. When Nandamaraj was taken away by one of Varuna's servants, Nanda's companions began to call loudly for Krishna and Balaram. Immediately, Krishna and Balaram could understand that Nandamaraj had been taken by a servant of Varuna. And thus, they went to the abode of Varuna. So they were pledged to give protection to the inhabitants of Vrindavan, who were all unalloyed devotees of the Lord. So Krishna and Balaram came there to protect Nandamaraj. So Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains the pastime, saying that when Krishna got there, immediately the residents of Vrindavan told him that your father has gone down deep into the water. And Krishna, of course, immediately was going to save him, to protect his father. But he told Balaram, but there's no mention of Balaram going down, even though they're talking about Krishna going, he's going to go down to protect him. So there's no mention of Balaram going into the water. And according to Srila Jiva Goswami, Krishna told Balaram, and it's interesting also that there's differences in the explanations of Jiva Goswami about how what happened in the past time and Kavikarnapur in this past time. My favorite is, but they're both very, very sweet, as is of course the Bhagavatam. But my favorite is Srila Jiva Goswami's. Krishna told Balaram to go to immediately to Vrindavan and tell Mother Yasoda that there's nothing to worry about, and you make sure she doesn't come to the river. Because if Mother Yasoda would witness or hear about what Krishna was just going to do, what is Krishna going to do? What is Krishna going to do? What can he do first? What is, before he does that, he's standing on the shore of the river, he's going to jump in, and then what's going to happen? He's going to jump in and go to Varuna. But what's he going to look like from the shore?
He's going to disappear.
Yeah. So if Mother Yasoda is there, and sees first Nanda going in and not into the water and returning, and then her son going into the water and not returning, Krishna thought, she's not going to stay alive. And she's going to go in or she'll just die on the spot. So he told Balaram to go there and make sure that I can deal with Varuna. I can't do both at the same time. So please, don't let her come, and assure that everything's going to be alright. So Balaram immediately went there and made sure that Mother Yasoda knew that everything was going to be alright, because Balaram's credibility was high. Why? Do you remember?
Because he assured everyone that there was nothing in the first Krishna one Krishna.
Oh, yes.
When Krishna was up with Kamala, everyone had gone mad. Because, Krishna was in danger. This snake was wrapped around him and killed him, basically. And Mother Yasoda was kept alive. They were sprinkling water on her. They were just telling pastimes loudly in her ear. Balaram was telling everyone, it's gone. Everyone else was in the greatest misery. Balaram was smiling. He said, it's all right. How is Krishna going to be put in difficulty by some serpent of this world? So some of the residents of Vrindavan, just seeing that Balaram loves Krishna as much as we do, and because Krishna and Balaram were always together, they were never separated at all, except sometimes, but they were always together, they were inseparable, and there was so much love between them. So they thought, Balaram's not in anxiety, so he's going to be alright. And then when it was proved that Krishna was alright, he came out of the water, then everyone was Balaram, and Balaram really knows what's right and what's going to happen. And they trusted him. So here, because Balaram was saying, don't go, Mother. Oh, Maya, don't go. Krishna's going to be alright. So Mother sort of stayed alive in the way. But Sri Kavi Kanapur describes, the condition of Srimati Radharani when Krishna jumped in. Do you remember that? It's one of the most intense things you'll ever read. When Srimati Radharani either heard or saw that Krishna had entered the water, she went completely unconscious. And she was going to die. And her friends, one intelligent friend of hers, said, no, Krishna's right here. He hasn't gone in the water. Krishna is right here in front of you. In other words, she told a lie. So Madhurani immediately opened her eyes to hear that Krishna was in front of her. So that stopped her from dying. Who can understand the love of Srimati Radharani for Krishna? And since Krishna, when you heard how Krishna always protected all the residents of Vrindavan because they were devotees, So how much did Krishna protect Srimati Radharani, who is the most intimate with him? They loved Dasamatha Vrindavan and the Braj Gopis loved Krishna so much the blinking of their eyes caused them intense feelings of separation. So Srimati Radharani then immediately hearing that Krishna was in front of her opened her eyes, but then she didn't see Krishna, so she just stared unconscious but with her eyes open. And Kavi Kanapur says that the burning spear in her heart that she couldn't see Krishna and thinking that Krishna had entered the water came out her eyes in the form of hot tears. So this is Vrindavan. This is what Vrindavan's like. That Krishna is so much beloved of all the residents of Vrindavan that we cannot even conceive. And then when in Cantonese they say, they say Mo Oi Chai, which means I love tea. But obviously, we say, oh, I love this, and I love that, and I love this, and I love that. But when we hear of what love is, then we understand that we are cold, the coldest hearted, that we don't even have any experience of what love is, and etc., etc., etc. So hearing about the residents of Vrindavan, Lord Krishna, who will say, yes, are you a devotee? Yes, I'm a devotee. Who will say that? Are you a congregational member? Not quite. Are you a conditioned soul stuck in the material world, stuck in a material mind and only thinking about yourself? Oh, now you've described me. Okay, that's a little more accurate. So the residents of Vrindavan, they were pledged to give protection to, excuse me, Krishna was pledged to give protection to the residents of Vrindavan who were all unalloyed devotees of the Lord. Devotees, having no shelter other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead, naturally cried to him for help. Exactly like children who do not know anything but the protection of their parents. That's what it means to be a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if one in difficulty actually cries for Krishna, to Krishna for help, like a baby crying for his mother, because why does the baby cry for his mother? Why? Do you remember, Sava?
No.
Milk, yeah, he's thirsty, wants some milk, but there are other ways to get milk. Huh? They only know one way, they only know one person when they're in need. They only know one person, and that person is mum. So the devotees mean they only know one person. They do not know anything but the protection. Exactly like children who do not know anything but the protection of their parents, they naturally cry to help. So that they think, I need some help now. Who should I cry for? Maybe I should go here. Maybe I should go there. Maybe I should do this. No, I shouldn't do that. No, actually, I'm trying to be a devotee, so I should call out to Krishna for help. There's no thought processes even that lead them to the conclusion to call out to Krishna for help. It's all completely natural and, what's the other word? Spontaneous, exactly. The residents of Vrindavan are completely on this. Everything is natural and spontaneous for them because that is the nature of their loving relationship with Krishna. So this is so exalted. This is so exalted. This is the topmost consciousness in existence. That in and of itself is such an amazing concept. It's the topmost consciousness in existence. In existence. In all existence. In all the different types of consciousnesses that there are. This is the topmost. There's nothing beyond this. Except, of course, say, being a servant. So this is so wonderful. So when Krishna came before Varuna, I'll read here and then I'll describe. Then Varuna offered some prayers. And then, if we have time, oh, it's already after 8, how did that happen? I'll read a little though. I'll just read this paragraph. I immediately received Krishna, my dear Lord. Actually, at this very moment, because of your presence, my life as the Dhanabad Varuna has become successful. So this, Varuna said, is my perfection. That you have come here and I'm having your darshan. Now, just imagine what Krishna's mood was, though. Swami describes that in some detail. But what do you think Krishna was, you know, in a joyful, jolly mood? His father had just been kidnapped, taken away, and presumably drowned. So he wasn't in a pleased, very happy, jolly mood. He was very angry, actually. But when Varuna was so respectful, his anger immediately cooled. My dear Lord, actually, at this very moment, because of your presence, my life as the demigod Varuna has become successful. Although I am deprived of all the treasures in the water, I know that such possessions do not make for a successful life. And at this moment, as I look at you, my life is made completely successful because by seeing you, I no longer have to accept the material body. Therefore, O Lord, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Supreme Brahman, and Super Soul of everything, let me offer my respects and obeisances unto you. Now, it's important to know that Nandaraj was aware that Varuna, look what this is, because we're again looking at it from different perspectives. So we're hearing Varuna's perspective. He's thinking, he's trying to cool Krishna's anger, and he's thinking, I'm so fortunate, my life is fortunate. I've had Shakshad Darshan of Krishna, I've directly seen Krishna, the unlimitedly powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead. I possess the wealth of the ocean. That all the oceans, all the pearls, all the jewels, or whatever that's in the ocean, but they're nothing. This is my real wealth. This is my fortune. Because this, seeing Krishna, means that I'm not going to see repeated birth and death. Kunti Devi says this too. There is no possibility. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Supreme Brahman, and the Super Soul. You are Bhagavan, Dharmatma, and Brahman. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto you. He doesn't say, let me become you. Let me become one with you. Let me have Ishwara Sayuja or Brahma Sayuja. No, I just want to offer my respectful obeisances to you. Because I'm your insignificant servant. You are the Supreme Transcendental Personality. There is no possibility of imposing the influence of material nature upon you. I am very sorry that my foolish man, by not knowing what to do or what not to do, has mistakenly arrested your father, Nanda Maharaj. So I beg your pardon for the offense of my servant. I beg your pardon because Krishna is the all-powerful, all-strong, supreme lord and all powerful and angry. So he better beg his pardon. Please forgive me, please forgive me, please forgive me. But then he says, I think that it was your plan to show me your mercy by your personal presence here. Look what it took for me to have your darshan. Your mercy in allowing your father to be kidnapped and brought to my abode. My dear Lord Krishna, Govinda, be merciful unto me. Here is your father. You can take him back immediately. In this way, Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, rescued his father and presented him before his father's friends, bringing them great jubilation. Okay, so that part of the pastime is sort of completed. Now tomorrow I would like to explain again, but from the point of view that Jiva Goswami describes it. It's really something very special and wonderful, one of my favorite. Any questions or comments? What do you think, Swabha?
Well, nice pickup from Varuna. So, you're gonna dash him. Very smart.
But he doesn't seem like he has something directly to do with it.
Yeah, but since he knew before Krishna came, so he could just imagine how he heard him without waiting for Krishna.
But that would be very dangerous, because he knew that Krishna was going to come. And then he would be very angry, and that if he could return him, but without an official apology, Krishna would still be angry. And if Krishna is angry at someone, there is a problem.
Couldn't he just walk on the water and say, I'm here?
Who, Varuna?
Yeah.
It's not so easy. Unless Krishna wants to see you, how can you go and see him?
Well, that was Yamuna.
But he wasn't in the Yamuna, he was in the channel. With Tiki.
You can't
put Nandamara
back and
solve. This is my greatest fortune. Jiva Goswami describes it, and I'll tell you now what he says, but he describes a little bit that answers your question. Any other questions or comments?
It's conflicting is this idea of independence and dependence, because through the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, they're exalted because they're considered independent, or a man's exalted over a woman because he's considered independent, whereas a woman's considered dependent, or a subject's considered dependent. But when it comes to Krishna, everything's in reverse, where being dependent is a good quality, being independent is sort of...
Well, one point on that is that no one is independent of Krishna. So when we talk about... depends on you're independent or dependent from, whether you're considered, whether it's a good or bad quality. If you're in an ocean, independent of a boat, it's dangerous. And if someone is, Kshatriyas aren't independent of Krishna ever, they're independent of or Brahmins, they're independent of certain things and dependent on others. What is a Kshatriya independent of?
He rules, so he's somebody does something, he's not ruling.
Yeah, he's independent of employment, because he has to depend on his own strength. So there's a particular mentality he has to cultivate that is independent of the... This is it for a king or something. independent of the strength of others, independent of the mercy of others, something like that. And what's the Brahman independent of?
Can express truth even if it's bad for him or whatever is there.
Independent of a livelihood that's based on compromise and conditions that he has to.
But everyone thought of themselves as dependent on higher powers. So. And also, in particular, especially Kshatriyas, due to the mind passion. When they're fighting, they're in a particular mood. They have to be in a particular mood to protect. And everyone in Vedic time was dependent on Shastra, and Kshatriya dependent on the mercy of the Brahmins.
And the Brahmins also dependent on the Guru. The Guru's mercy.
And Shastra. I think it's one of the aspects of the Vedic culture is that no one thought themselves independent, actually. But that what you are dependent on and independent of varies according to your position in society. I think that's one of the specific aspects, is that no one felt themselves independent.
You
always felt yourself under someone.
Depending on the Shastra and the Guru.
Yeah.
Whereas the Sudra is dependent upon his master.
Yeah.
His master's orders may not be very Shastric. Is that the point? That's so you get a job, and the job may tell you to, you know, cook meat or something. But it's your job, you have to do it.
If you're a Sudra, or are you talking about nowadays?
It's a Sudra nowadays.
But who gets the karma? If your master tells you to do something directly, tells you to do something, and you're just following, beautifully following orders, who gets the action?
I thought both did. Like master and the master said, tells you to get out the wine and pour wine for his function. This was a corporate meeting. They had a business meeting and they have a glass of wine here, and so the sugar pulls that glass of wine from people there.
You're talking about nowadays.
Nowadays, yeah.
But nowadays, they're not acting as sudras, they're getting paid for it. They're not dutifully acting, they're fruitively acting. So if you're fruitively acting, you get all the fruit, not just the fruits that you want. But when you're just a dutiful servant, the master gets. That's what, I mean, philosophically, that's what I would say.
Different from the modern sudra, the vague sudra.
No, I think the modern sudras are as exalted as sutras.
They're not part of the system.
Yeah. Exalted in the sense there's no sense of duty or loyalty. You can see that in the people had loyalty to them. Why? Because they had that's character. He's feeding me. How could I go against him? He's caring for me. I mean, this is theoretically. That's character. No one even feels like that about their parents nowadays.
The
you know,
sutras aren't even really sutras. You know, it's well, it's loads of the paradigms. Yeah. So that the sense that my master's maintaining, now everybody thinks they're entitled to be maintained. If I don't have a job, then the government has to be entitled.
Well, the government is supposed to, that's their most important. Keep people employed, engaged and employed according to their vana and ashrama. And fed, this is the prime responsibilities of the government, and then to keep out the rogues. But, you edit that out of the otherwise we'll be in big trouble. But it's a fault in Kali Yuga. It's very unnatural to disrespect all any figure of authority is harmful for our surrender to God. No. I'm not saying, but that's Kali Yuga. That all the authorities become corrupt. So therefore, people laugh at priests and laugh at the government and their parents of this and that and that. So no one has any experience of an authority in their life that's trustworthy, and it makes it very difficult to surrender to the supreme authority. So the Vanashrama culture gave you a particular mentality that wasn't in itself fully spiritual. It allowed you, it facilitated your surrender to God, to the supreme, and to follow. Well, that's the created order, but I'm saying something else. But it pervaded the proper mentality, is what I'm saying. Provided a proper mentality, it facilitated you having a proper mentality that made surrender and trust in the Supreme Personality of Godhead natural. Nowadays, it's so unnatural to trust any authority at all, so therefore when it comes to trusting the Supreme Authority, the way our psychology is it's not possible, but it's extremely difficult. It's possible by depth of prayer, etc., and deep sincerity, but it's difficult. It's always difficult. And how can I, no one trusts anyone. That's Kali Yuga. And then, as we were saying in the beginning, then we're forced to trust our rascal mind. And that's always, to think of the mind as a rascal, it's always glorified to do that. Because the mind is, by its very nature, untrustworthy.
But you were saying in the class at the Shabbat retreat that the mind is in the mode of goodness.
It comes from the mode of goodness. Bhagavatam for Kanto. Born from it.
So then why does the mind get all the criticism?
Well, who is the intelligence to serve?
Senses?
It serves the rascal mind. The mind says, I want. And the intelligence figures out the plan. That's what the mind does. It holds on to something. And the intelligence figures schemes. So the intelligence that serves the rascal mind is also criticized.
And that makes the mind the highest faculty in the intelligence.
Well, the mind is the highest. It rules. The mind rules. This is its realm.
Then we were talking about how the mind is actually simple.
Powerful. Simple in the sense that it's plotting. And it's not actually very subtle. In that sense, simple. It wants. It's like a naughty child. It wants. So a naughty child, it's very, very strong and unruly. It just wants. But it's simple. In that sense. And the intelligence works in a different way. The mind just wants, and it's averse. And when it wants something, sometimes you have to deal with it like a child. So, yes, it's all right, you'll get it. A little later. Why don't you just look at this right now? Oh, look over there. Look over there, look at the gottos. Bing, 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 bing. And the mind just immediately. It's like that. And it's gottos. And then, oh, look, movie screen. Oh, how nice, movie screen. Oh, light bulb. Oh, look, and the mind will just go jumping from one to the next, to the next, to the next. Like a like a child.
So who does? Who was the faculty that dealing with the mind in that example?
It's the intelligence. The intelligence was supposed to control the mind by the intelligence. And the intelligence is supposed to be ruled by Shastra. To get its categories for what's good and what's bad. It's not supposed to be based on what the mind thinks, but it's based on Shastra. That's the idea, to have Shastra chakshus. To allow the intellectual capacity to be influenced and trained by Shastra. That's what, one of the reasons we're here. And then if the mind relaxes, it gets a taste. Then it's very fortunate. But how do you learn what is good and what's bad? Not by what the mind wants.
What is the position of the consciousness that's aware of the debate that's going on between the mind and the intelligence?
Mixed. What is the position?
What is that?
That's the chitta. That's closer to that's the intelligence that's not yet fully pure. It's mixed.
It's aware of the intelligence in the mind's interaction.
That's the consciousness. That's closer to the person, but it's not the real consciousness of the soul. It's the consciousness of the soul that's somewhat enlightened in the case of the aspiring devotee. Because the consciousness of the soul is something. There's no identification of the body. It's relationship with Krishna. That's because that's who we are in relationship. We're always in relationship with Krishna. So the consciousness of the soul itself is always aware of Krishna. Unless it's taking the poison of Mayavada or impersonalism. It's natural consciousness, it's Krishna consciousness, aware of its relationship with Krishna. So this is the consciousness that's the chitta born of the material mode of goodness, as described in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, as opposed to born of soul itself. This is what gyanis do. They contemplate who they are and show, that's what neti is. Trying to discriminate, separate, and that's what Sankhya Yoga does too. All the elements. So that's exactly what the gyanis, this is basically Sankhya Yoga, mixed with yoga. That's what they did, that kind of thing. They can access a very entangled in there, trying to figure out who you are.
They try to separate themselves out.
Yes, exactly. And then find this, and then meditate on the super soul. So the process of abstracting themselves out and detaching themselves from the material elements and not engaging in material activities, so then the consciousness is elevated to the mode of goodness so that you can see properly. It's the interaction with the field of activities in the mood of an enjoyer that entangles us in the lower modes.
Do the Buddhists also try to do something like that?
But using different methodology. But yeah, by slowing down the mind, putting the mind in the mode of goodness. I mean, that's one of the Vipassana techniques.
And what is the relevance of those things to Krishna?
No bhakti. So you can't get to Krishna, but you can get to, you need some glimpses of spiritual realization. You can somewhat achieve Brahman. Then you're not really, you become partially self-aware because you're not aware of your relationship with Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So you can become aware of your eternal, clear consciousness, satam samzayate jnanam. Consciousness in the mode of goodness, you can become Vasudeva Savamiti. Jnani Charam Bharatasava. Because Satam Sanjay, that's what's born out of the mode of goodness. Knowledge. And then when the consciousness in the mode of goodness becomes aware of it, Vasudeva is anywhere, then it's the consciousness that allows you to do that is called Sudasattva. It's a little confusing in those points, but that's. Fascinating?
Yes, but it takes a long time to understand it.
Well, that's why we usually don't bother. That it's described in the Bhagavad Gita, but it's, Yeah. Well, that's the business of jnanis, is the, that's what they do.
You can think of it as
it's fascinating. I find it fascinating. Having that tendency myself. But it's not bhakti. When it's connected to Krishna.
Then the same thing when you go down the materialistic path, again, the quantum mechanics or something, and then it becomes understandable.
Yeah.
It's just people, it gets into somebody's theory against somebody else's theory, and there's no experiment that can distinguish who's right. It's just a matter of philosophy. Interesting enough, the same thing happens when you go down the ultimate materialistic path. Same problem when you get into all these categories and
And in this path, though, in the jnana path, because there's some authority in it, and then also you can't get any result without some bhakti, so you can actually get a result, not just more further questions. In the quantum mechanics path, you just get further questions, quarks and gluons, and what's, you know, what happens. And what they try to do, one day I figured this out, that there's something so demonic in that methodology. Because not in quantum mechanics specifically, but the way that the modern scientists are trying to find the atomic particles and subatomic particles, it's so gross too. They take a subatomic atom, and then they just take up another atom or a subatomic particle and just speed it up. Wonk! Smash the atom. It's just this gross methodology. And then they find the subatomic particle. Somehow or another, they stabilize the subatomic particle long enough to take another subatomic particle and then wonk! And smash it. And, you know, you break it apart and see what you do. And then that's their idea. And my conclusion was, just imagine if they got to the super soul. Of course, they can't, because then they would just find something. Trying to see what's inside of God. But you can only see what's inside of God if you use a different methodology. That's our point. What is inside of him? He explains it in the ninth canto of the Bhagavad Gita. My devotion is in my heart. And then, okay, now I found something. Wonk! What's in the heart of the devotee? Oh, it's Krishna. Wait a second. I don't know what's in his heart. It's his podium.
They have a smashing mentality.
It's gross. But to find out absolute truth, you need some different methodology. Yeah. To find out what it's like.
It's like if you take a
paper
cutter, right?
Like a kid.
Yeah,
kids. It's gross.
It would seem as though if you were to try to become conscious in that way, like a jnani type, not a jnani sake, but more aware of goodness of your mind and your intelligence and so forth, you could become, as I say for myself, you could become to a point of extreme sort of humbleness because of the size. Like, what can a soul actually understand?
I think the only path is the other side, is you can come to the extreme pride.
You wouldn't have had a Mayavad context to
it. To become the supreme. And the Buddhist. The Buddhist has something. I don't know if it's not anything. They become nothing. That I guess you can be proud of being nothing.
But they probably are.
And that means they're not very realized. Because how can you be part of being nothing? Because your pride is also nothing. You're just nothing. If you realize, you can't even be alive because you're nothing. At least you're not suffering because you're nothing. Don't go there. Don't go there.
The child to the doctor, and he's got some disease, and the doctor says, "It is really easy to cure this. I'll just tell him." No.
Okay, we better stop. It's too late. Kal. You have to have blessings to be able to do that kind of subtle stuff, too. The jnani stuff. To be successful. You have to have blessings so you can't do it by your own power, actually. Because that's why, to get the result of jnani, you need some bhakti devi who could give that result.
I'm not sure, but I forgot where it was. There's somewhere. There's something.